You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today has been fascinated by the big moments in human history, and he's written about two in his lifetime. His previous bestseller, Rocket Men, documented one, the space program, and his latest documents, The Taming of the Atom and the Creation of the Atomic Bomb. Greg Nelson writes a social history of the atomic age in his new book, The Age of Radiance, the epic rise and dramatic fall of the atomic era. The book tackles the scientific discoveries, X-ray, Madame Curie's radium, Fermi's experiments on the squash court underneath the University of Chicago Stadium, Los Alamos and the making of the bomb, mutually assured destruction, Chernobyl, and the Japanese meltdown at Fukushima. But it also examines how we've reacted to this new age in popular culture. Things like Dr. Strangelove, fallout shelters, radium jewelry, X-ray foot fittings, the China syndrome, and our fears of radioactivity. And that latter theme is one of the central tenets of the book, that while radiation can be harmful, our fears have greatly outweighed the true dangers. While, in fact, he believes that the nuclear age is passing, Nelson writes that mutually assured destruction kept the Cold War cold, and that the predictions of skyrocketing cancer from nuclear accidents have been overblown. In fact, if the worst predictions of Chernobyl come true, and that's far from certain, the cancer deaths would only equal the number of people estimated to die each year from the pollution caused by using coal in power plants. It's a very interesting and provocative book, The Age of Radiance. It's published by Scribner, and Craig Nelson is my guest today. Craig Nelson, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for the invitation.
Your book, The Age of Radiance, reads as a social history of the atomic age, because you tell the story of the scientific discoveries about radioactivity in the atomic age, but also as much on our perceptions, our reactions to this knowledge. What was the beginnings of this book?
Well, when I first started this, I was really surprised to find out that almost everything I knew about nuclear science and nuclear history was wrong. I thought that, you know, if you said the word radioactive to me, the first thing I would think of would be cancer, infection, danger, all of the sort of fears that I think a lot of people have about this topic. And also, I thought that it was extremely rare. So I thought radioactive things were extremely rare and extremely dangerous. And I found out neither, which is true. Radioactivity comes out of our cats. It comes out of each of us. Human beings are radioactive. It's coming out of the ground from uranium. It's coming falling from the skies from cosmic rays. It's in every granite building. It's in adobe. It's in cat litter. It's in bananas. It's in Brazil nuts. It's just all over the place. So it's only dangerous if you get a big dose. So that was the amazing thing to find out. And in fact, one thing I hope your listeners could help me with, I ran out of time in my research, but part of what I discovered was that all human beings are radioactive, and we get together, we irradiate each other. So I'm wondering now if that combined with pheromones produces human chemistry. So if someone could look into that and get back to me, I'd really appreciate it.
Well, that is one of the first things you write in the book, that radiation, radioactivity is all around us. And the fact that I love the way you describe radioactive elements. Basically, they're essentially American because they're fat. They're morbidly obese atoms.
Right. The amazing thing is, you know, while I thought radiation was so scary, the minute I learned into the science, it's fact made from chubby little atoms. So they're buying the husky pants at Sears. And these chubby little atoms are so fat that they break the force that binds together all matter in the universe and spit out little pieces of themselves. They spit out two kinds of subatomic particles, and then they spit out a little energy beam called a gamma ray, which is sort of like an X-ray or light. It's made of photons. So these three things are what radioactivity is made of, and you can think of these atoms as sort of being like Hollywood starlets, unstable and bulimic. And but they do are charming, you know, when Marie Curie came into her lab in the morning before the sun was up, she would leave out her radium, so it was all glowing on the walls when she came in. And when you hold a piece of plutonium, it's warm like a puppy.
Interesting. Well, you know, and you actually show us the way uranium-238 eventually ends up as a stable element, lead, and it goes through, let's see, I'm looking at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 different iterations with various elements and at various atomic weights before it ends up at lead.
Well, what is really frightening was that when people first split the atom, and realize what they had done, they were really frightened because for hundreds of years, science had been ruled by alchemists who were constantly trying to turn elements into something else. Primarily, they were trying to create artificial gold, but the whole science was done by this fraudulent alchemy. And when these two split the atom, they realized they were alchemizing. They were taking an element and turning it into another element, and they thought their scientific reputations would be destroyed because they would be tarred and feathered as alchemists.
Now, the story actually begins with the scientific discoveries. First, Röntgen discovering X-rays, then the Curies discovering radium. What was interesting about that particular part of the learning about this early history as science begins to understand how elements work and how radioactive elements work?
Well, what I really loved about doing this is finding the incredible joy and awe these people had in the magic of their discoveries. So, for example, Röntgen is this washed-up 50-year-old physics professor at that hotbed of research, the University of Würzburg, which is, you know, a Middle Ages town. It's very pretty, but it isn't where anyone wants to go for a science career. And physicists make their reputations in their 20s, so being 50, you are really good. And Röntgen, like, lives with his wife upstairs from the lab. And his lab sort of looks like a poor man's version of a Frankenstein lab, because everyone at that time was investigating electricity. And Röntgen took a vacuum tube and charged it very powerfully and saw that a screen on the other side of his lab was glowing. And he realized that the current coming out of that tube on one end was making the screen glow. And by accident, his hand fell before the screen and he saw the bones in his hand. And that's when he became so alarmed, he wouldn't tell anyone what he was doing for weeks and weeks, because he thought people would think he was crazy, and that's why he called them X-rays, for X is the unknown.
Well, then you go into the Curies. What I really found interesting was the story of Madame Curie, Marie Curie. You know, after the radium, we discover radium, all of a sudden, I'd never known this, but for many years, Madame Curie was thought to be a woman with a brain, not a heart. And you tell the story of her private life, the fact that when Pierre Curie died, she was devastated for years. And then all of a sudden, she found new love and she reemerges in the world. It was a really fascinating story.
Well, I really love finding this out, because when I first started doing this research, and I kept reading over and over again how Madame Curie was this soulless brainiac who had no heart. The first 10 years I lived in New York City, I lived in an Eastern European neighborhood, and I just kept thinking, this doesn't sound like any Polish woman I ever met. So I started looking into the background of this. And the incredible story is that 6 years after her husband died, and she was really traumatized, she kept something called a mourning journal that I had to keep myself from including more of in the book, because it's so heartbreaking and it's so passionate and it's such an incredible piece of writing, the journal she kept after her husband's death. But Marie falls in love with this younger guy who was a student of her husband's named Paul. And he was also a very well-known physicist. In fact, there's a picture in the book of all the most famous physicists in the world gathering at a conference. And who's sitting next to Einstein? Paul. So anyway, they're just perfect for each other, except Paul is married. And his wife is not interested in being cheated on with the most famous woman in France. And her brother works for a tabloid newspaper. So she causes this incredible scandal. And where Marie gets ready to go to Scandinavia to pick up her second Nobel Prize, she was the first woman to win one Nobel Prize, and she is only one of four people to win two. The people in Sweden said, well, maybe you shouldn't come right now. Maybe you could come another time, because it was such a scandal. But the great coincidence that happened is that the love affair broke up. Paul went back to his wife, which broke her heart all over again. But he introduced her to one of his own students named Fred. And she hired Fred to work in her lab. And after a year, Fred told Marie, I'm in love with your daughter, Erin, and we're going to get married. And Marie said, well, I don't think so. And she had sort of a fit about this and made Fred sign one of the first prenups in history. But she was wrong. Fred and Erin had a fantastic marriage and a fantastic professional partnership. They discovered artificial radiation, which is a cornerstone of nuclear medicine and as important today in modern medicine as the microscope. And because of this wild chain of circumstances, Erin was the second woman to win a Nobel Prize, her mother Marie having been the first.
Oh, that's a really interesting story. And there's another part of the story that goes along with these discoveries is how we as human beings have reacted to this knowledge. And I think you're right that, you know, at the same time we fear radioactivity, the word radioactivity can sort of make us stop and listen carefully. But you said at the same time we've had this strange attraction to these discoveries, X-rays at first. We were putting X-rays, you know, we were doing X-rays for all sorts of the wrong reasons. Radium, we had radium jewelry. And after the atomic bomb, you know, what's a few hundred atomic bombs exploded in the atmosphere? We've kind of had this strange attraction to these discoveries until we begin to realize there are really, truly dangers about them.
Well, the original discovery, of course, is just incredible. And then it takes a while for the side effects to sink in. So, for example, the city of Hamburg has a monument to the martyrs of nuclear science, and there are over 300 names on that list, including Marie and Irene, both of whom died from working with radioactive materials, as most likely did Enrico Fermi, who created the first nuclear reactor at an abandoned football stadium in the middle of Chicago. And so all of the side effects come second, you know. I don't know if you're old enough, but when I was a child, they had this box to X-ray your foot to measure you for shoes. And everybody had these, every shoe store had these boxes. And kids were having their feet X-rayed over and over again because it was so cold to look at the bones in your foot. Well, it's just amazing there isn't this massive incidence of foot cancer in the baby boomer generation from doing this. And so you see this kind of thing happening over and over again, where what starts out as being this fantastic breakthrough and a miracle turns out to have unforeseen consequences. And the history repeats over and over and over again. And I hope that someday we'll learn how to live with mixed blessings.
Yeah. Well, and that's one of the takeaways from this book, I think, is the fact that that perception of fear regarding radioactivity is perhaps greater than its reality.
Well, the real amazing thing to me that I discovered was learning about the now almost six-decade study of the people who survived Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And, you know, considering what we think about radiation, the idea of survivors of a nuclear attack, we would think they would be covered in cancerous lesions, that they would have all these genetic mutations, you know, every single thing that we know about nuclear and everything we fear about it should have happened with this group of people. But instead, there's been no genetic mutations, and there's only been a 1% increase in cancer. So when you think about all the fears and everything we're worried about with nuclear, and it is dangerous. I mean, don't get me wrong. If you hold that little plutonium puppy too long in your hand at Los Alamos, you would have to have your arms amputated. So, I mean, I'm not trying to underplay this, but still, when you think of the terrible fears we've all had about radiation, just the very word radioactivity, and these people who are attacked with atomic bombs had only a 1% increase in cancer, that's a pretty big gulf.
I was really surprised to read that as of, I think, a couple of years ago, 40% of the survivors of Hiroshima were still living.
Yes.
I think that would shock a lot of people, that one
yeah.
statistic. What is that, almost 75 years ago?
Yes, exactly.
And 40% of the survivors are still alive. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. And the other incredible irony is that a couple of months after Hiroshima was bombed, it was struck by a giant typhoon, and the city was really devastated, but that typhoon washed away all the radiation. So now Hiroshima, as far as ecologically speaking goes, is in much better shape than Nevada, where the United States tested all of its nuclear weapons.
Now, that is a real concern, and it has been a public health concern for a long time, the effect of atmospheric testing in Nevada. What has been the increased risk for, say, people of that region as well as across the country?
Well, it's taken almost, 50 years to get the truth out about this situation. And this is actually the great tragedy of the Cold War, is the fact that basically the entire continent is now polluted with radioactive contaminants from those tests. and 11,000 Americans die of cancer every year to this day because of the pollution from those tests. And the exact same thing has happened in the Soviet Union with their tests from their desert in Kazakhstan. So all that time, we were worried about the Soviet Union dropping atomic bombs on us and nuclear irradiating us with nuclear poisons. We were doing having it done to us by our own government.
My guest today is Craig Nelson, the author of the bestseller Rocket Men. His latest book is titled The Age of Radiance, The Epic Rise and Dramatic Fall of the Atomic Era. It's published by Scribner. Well, that takes us into the idea of what you would write as the overblown dangers, or perceived dangers, from a nuclear power. And you go through several of those emergencies, Chernobyl, Fukushima, and Three Mile Island. In fact, in Three Mile Island, you said everything worked pretty well.
Well, my conclusion about nuclear power is that eventually it's going to go away, not because of its own problems, but because the government and the industry have so mishandled this. It's really unbelievable to see how much ineptitude combines with nuclear power. But anyway, and Three Mile Island is the great example. All of American nuclear plants, first of all, are based on a design that was created for the American Navy to use as its power plant in submarines. And we have not had a single problem with that power source in the Navy. And the one big problem we had at Three Mile Island, the whole core, half of it melted down. So it was really a disaster, except that the containment kept it from contaminating anybody. There is not a single person who got a single dose of radiation in the neighboring towns and counties of Pennsylvania outside of Three Mile Island. But what happened was that the movie The China Syndrome was playing at the same time that Three Mile Island happened. So while Walter Cronkite announced on the evening news that there might be a meltdown in Pennsylvania, The China Syndrome was talking about how if the nuclear reactor blew up in California, it would contaminate an area the size of Pennsylvania. I mean, the coincidences were just wild. So I like to say that Americans' fear of nuclear stems from the fact that we first learned about nuclear science from seeing pictures of the victims of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And then we learned about nuclear power from Three Mile Island and the China Syndrome. So, of course, we don't think much of it.
No. Now, in the case of Chernobyl and Fukushima, you had some serious mishandling of nuclear materials and actual amounts of radiation going into the atmosphere. I get the sense from reading that you think that the fears are real but overblown.
Well, this is the essential story. The worst nuclear accident of all time was Chernobyl, and it was particularly nasty because the Soviets do not use these containment domes, which is what's keeping Fukushima from having any real atmospheric fallout, okay? So they used a concrete shield that they could move back and forth over their reactors so they could change the fuel and make plutonium for atomic warheads as well as electricity for Ukrainians at Chernobyl. And so when it blew up, it spewed an atomic fire that took 2 weeks to put out, and it created a cloud of radioactive fallout the size of 400 Hiroshimas that spread over all of Europe. So I guess what I would think is, how many people do your listeners imagine would die from such a thing happening? You know, we would think, what, tens of thousands of people, right? The total is 75. 58 of the people died at the plant because they were so exposed to radiation, including a number of firefighters. And then a group of children died because they did not evacuate from the contaminated area and they drank the milk from cows that had eaten the grass that was contaminated by dust coming up under the ground. So, but when you think about it, considering the horrible effect of what happened there and considering the unlikelihood that that would, kind of thing would ever happen again, that's a very small number of people. So some people think that that 75 number is too small, and one of them has insisted that actually 16,000 people are going to die from the cancers out of that cloud. So let's say he's right. Every year in the United States, 16,000 people die from the pollution caused by coal.
Yeah, and power plants, that's right.
Right.
And I think that's the whole thing, is we don't put these fears in terms of the relative risk.
Yes, exactly. So when we hear about, 75 people dying, that sounds so terrible, but that's nothing compared to the people that get killed because of the petrochemical industry. So,
yeah. Now, what's your thoughts on Fukushima at this point? I mean, this is still sort of a story in play, even 2 years later now.
Well, the terrible tragedy is actually that the core burns through the ground, gets through the floor, and enters the groundwater. And they say they put up barricades to keep that from happening, but I can't imagine that, So I assume that they're going to have an environmental contamination. And, the Japanese are very interested in cleanliness. That's sort of one of their big ideas. And the people who survived Hiroshima and Nagasaki were sort of treated like lepers. They had trouble moving out or living elsewhere because people thought they were contaminated. And now the same thing is happening to people from Fukushima. They're sort of considered unclean and tainted. So that entire social issue is a terrible problem for these people. And, of course, the Japanese think that the government is spending almost $1 billion to try and clean up Fukushima and make it inhabitable again. But who would ever want to live there? So I just can't imagine that that's going to succeed.
And I think your takeaway is that nuclear power is doomed, mainly because of the reactions of the Japanese, the Soviet Union government at that particular time. They tried to cover up the extent of what had happened and were pretty incompetent in how they tried to contain everything.
They should have been able to tell us at Three Mile Island that everyone was safe and the safety things, even though there was this series of errors that led to this big catastrophic accident, everything they did kept the citizens safe, and they couldn't even do that. So, and at Fukushima, they tried covering up everything. In fact, I can't absolutely say that no one at the plant died because it's conceivable that the government and the company, TEPCO, that runs the plant, have kept that from the public. It's very possible. They're very buttoned-down duo, the industry and the government, when it comes to this topic. And with Chernobyl, they tried to keep the entire thing a secret, but it set off radiation alarms in Sweden, and that's how they found out about that. So, there's this whole history of the government trying to keep things quiet, somewhat responsively, because if you cause a bunch of people to panic, then that's worse than the actual problem caused by the nuclear accident itself. But even so, there's such a history of government silence and ineptitude and industries not doing anything to educate people on this that it's their own fault that no one wants this anymore.
My guest today is Craig Nelson. His new book is titled The Age of Radiance, The Epic Rise and Dramatic Fall of the Atomic Era. It's a social history of the atomic age. It's published by Scribner. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, you can't talk about the atomic age without talking about nuclear weapons and the weaponization of the atom. And you certainly do that. And you tell the story of the creation of the atomic bomb and the immediate years after the atomic bomb when we're developing hydrogen bombs. And you talk about how Alfred Nobel at one point was hoping that dynamite would be and TNT would be the discovery that would keep man from having war. And perhaps it is the nuclear. Certainly we've had our share of wars, but we've never had full-out world war again since the beginning of the nuclear age. You seem to be a proponent that the mutually assured destruction has actually worked in that regard.
Well, I know the people listening to this show are a smart bunch of guys and gals, so here's your brain twister for today. Now, I'm not saying I completely agree with this, but it certainly is an interesting thing to think about. So let's back up a little bit. Alfred Nobel made his fortune from inventing TNT dynamite, and he said that his great unrealized dream in life was to create a weapon so formidable that people could no longer go to war anymore because of this weapon. And a number of people feel that because every party involved, not just the United States and the Soviet Union, but also China and France and Britain and a number of other countries, because all of them had nuclear arsenals, nothing ever happened during the Cold War. And, you can say, yes, there is Vietnam and yes, there is Korea, but you say during the whole time of the Cold War, when the U.S. and the USSR were these terrible adversaries. The only direct combat we had was a couple of little fighter planes and dogfights over Korea. And, one of my favorite anecdotes is Ronald Reagan is talking to Margaret Thatcher, and he tells her his great dream is to end all nuclear weapons forever. And Thatcher is horrified because she's convinced that everyone having nuclear arsenals kept the Cold War cold. So the great big brain twister for people to ponder is, should the inventors of thermonuclear weapons be given the Nobel Peace Prize?
I'm not sure about that, but
exactly.
But let me ask you. This is in the news today with what's happening in Ukraine. I've heard a number of political analysts says this is the end of non-proliferation efforts in the world because the Ukraine had nuclear weapons at the breakup of the Soviet Union. They voluntarily gave them up, and this is a horrible. What's happening there now is. Every country that has nuclear weapons or has a nuclear program is looking at that and saying, that's why we need to have these.
Well, if you look at the entire history post-Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the United States had nuclear weapons and Vietnam didn't help the United States. The French had nuclear weapons and the Algerians didn't help France. The Soviet Union had nuclear weapons and Afghanistan didn't help the Soviet Union. So almost every single instance of conflict going, oh, and in Korea, which ended up being Soviet Union and China against the U.S., that was basically a draw. That ended as a stalemate. So in almost all these different conflicts, in each case, one side had atomic weapons and the other side didn't, and it didn't help at all. So that's number one. Number two, it seems that everyone who gets them now gets them as a defensive posture. For example, in Iran, there wasn't this big run-up going forward with trying to bring in this Pakistani centrifuges to make fissile fuel for bombs until the United States invaded Iraq. And that's what triggered the upsurge in them wanting to have an atomic bomb. Mm. So it seems to me that at some point we're all going to give up on having these wildly expensive atomic weapons that no one ever uses, and they'll be like trebuchets or blunderbusses. They'll just be the ridiculous old-fashioned thing that no one in their right mind would pay for.
Interesting. Well, after spending 5 years working on this book, and it goes into every aspect of the atomic age, what do you think our biggest misconception about radioactivity is?
I think that people think they need to worry about power plants. So here's what your listeners need to worry about when it comes to radioactivity. Okay, number one, use sunscreen. Number two, have your basement checked for radon. And number three, if you or a member of your family is getting a huge number of medical diagnostic tests, make sure that someone is overseeing how much radiation you're getting. That's it. You don't have to worry about Fukushima. You don't have to worry about atomic weapons, all of these big, scary things. You don't have to worry about. You have to worry about the sun.
All right. Well, the name of the book is The Age of Radiance. Craig Nelson, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
Craig Nelson is the author of several award-winning and best-selling histories. His latest book is The Age of Radiance, The Epic Rise and Dramatic Fall of the Atomic Era. It's published by Scribner. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.